There is a dance danced by the political animals we call human beings. When we dance around the truth, it is called the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. And the more political you are, the more ornate and baroque your moves. We dance around the truth when the truth is not convenient for us. For nearly 70 years, some of the most impressive and dazzling moves have been danced when people are dancing the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot over the issue of Israel and Palestine. And now my own country of Aotearoa is busting a move, dancing the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot in no less a venue than New York at the UN Security Council itself. But to understand this, perhaps it's worth considering a little background on this country.
Aotearoa, better known by its slave name of New Zealand, because European explorers, on seeing a country full of glaciers and rainforests and snow-capped mountain ranges and so forth, could be easily forgiven for wanting to name it after a small flat piece of land in the Netherlands. Anyway, Aotearoa feels itself to be a plucky little country that punches above its weight.
This is the source of our sense of exceptionalism, and
a lot of people would think, well, exceptionalism is what happens in the USA, but any country that defines itself by its own mythology is prone to exceptionalism. Exceptionalism is simply the tendency to see what you do as defined by who you think yourself as being, rather than to examine what you do and judge it the way you would judge it if anyone else did it. For Aotearoa, our own self-image says that we are exceptionally nice people, more civilized than anyone else apart from possibly the Scandinavians and maybe in some context the Swiss or something like that. We see ourselves as inherently fair, and we believe that we command respect from other people beyond what you would normally expect for a country of our size. This notion has been fed over time by the British particularly, who found it was an exceptionally good idea to patronize New Zealanders in order to use them as cannon fodder. And I'm not joking about that. We have been used quite severely as cannon fodder. During World War I, 10% of the country was sent overseas, and of them, I think roughly 40% didn't come back. So we sent 10% of our entire population overseas and lost 4% of our population because the British ordered us to. We didn't get to vote on whether to declare war or anything like that. We were simply told, you're at war now, and we did our bit. Our actions after that, of course, bring into question the very notion that we're the nice people we say we are, because we promptly invaded Turkey and started killing young Turkish soldiers without any real justification. Now, the Turks have been very nice to us about this ever since, but if you think about it, I don't think it would be true. We would reciprocate if Turkey had invaded us in the same manner. In many ways, our role as a cat's paw of imperial powers hasn't changed that much. It's true that we do clearing mines and peacekeeping and so forth, but even those operations are often politically useful for imperial powers, and we are adding our flag to coalition forces that often are committing acts of aggression. We, of course, were part of the aggression against Vietnam, and we have never apologized to anyone for that. In fact, you know, like we take our cue from the US in these things, we tend to think of ourselves as the victims of, in Gallipoli, the victims of our British masters, but in Vietnam, victims of whatever. It's like we don't even understand what we're the victims of. We're just victims. Anyway, The fact is that these larger powers feed our inflated sense of self-importance in order to use us.
And where we used to provide excellent cannon fodder, we now seem to provide excellent stuffed shirts and self-important people. My favourite example of this would be Jeffrey Palmer, who is an incredibly nice guy. We know he's an incredibly nice guy because he's written two memoirs pointing out that he is an incredibly nice guy. And he was the chair of the committee that produced the Palmer Report. He was on the committee with Alvaro Uribe, the Colombian war criminal or mass murderer. And they produced this report that said that Israel was perfectly entitled to attack the Mavi Marmara because they refused to look into the legality of the blockade, and therefore they assumed that the blockade was legal, and therefore actions taken to enforce the blockade were legal. It's a kind of, well, you have to be quite an idiot to come up with that sort of logic, but, you know, they did. And as I said, Jeffrey Palmer, highly respected constitutional lawyer and all-round nice guy, did his wonderful job sitting next to his good friend, the mass murderer from Colombia. So that pretty much gives you an idea of our track record. And plucky little New Zealand, again, the mouse that roared, has spent loads of taxpayers' money in getting itself a seat on the United Nations Security Council, something which a few countries of our size have done, but we have repeatedly. And our great project in this has been a determination to decide to bring peace to the Middle East. Now, when I say peace to the Middle East, it seems that that we focused more on Israel-Palestine than other parts of the Middle East, like Syria. And apparently, a few days ago, New Zealand's UN Security Council delegations circulated a draft resolution about 2 pages long proposing a path towards a two-state solution. This is what Dr. Vasi Vlasna had to say about it. New Zealand, like all Western governments, obsequiously replicated Zionist propaganda in the resolution. New Zealand normalizes Israeli atrocities by falsely presenting Israel and Palestine as equal perpetrators and equal victims, and by pushing the demand that Palestine gives up its endeavor for justice in the International Criminal Court, thus letting Israel off scot-free for monstrous war crimes and crimes against humanity, while New Zealand demands that Israel freezes its rapacious settlements, in which New Zealand invests, it absurdly promotes the farce of negotiations that expand settlements, and then it obediently keeps up the pretense of a two-state solution when Netanyahu has repeatedly ruled out Palestinian sovereignty. New Zealand does not act on its recommendations and will not make a move first to recognize the Palestinian state, and loading more inanity on the ridiculous, New Zealand calls on the same incompetent clowns, the quartet, US, Russia, United Nations and the European Union, Security Council and Arabs, to maintain the posturing of the nihilistic negotiations. My apologies to Dr. Vlasna there for slightly mangling her words, but I think you get the picture. Well, the thing is this. What they're doing is using the camouflage of the rather irrational pretenses we all have about the Israel-Palestine situation and normalizing some rather bizarre pretenses we have that avoid the truth, and hence why I call it the whiskey tango foxtrot. So what I think we should do is actually go back through some basic stuff about Israel, Palestine, and where does justice lie, and why does Aotearoa have a particular legal and moral obligation to go much further and be much more honest than this resolution is. So, to begin with, Jewish migration to Palestine from Europe began before World War I. These waves of Jewish migration are called Aliyah, or rather Aliyot, which is the plural, it immediately started problems because a lot of the landowners were absentee landlords living in the more cosmopolitan areas of the Ottoman Empire, and their tenants were often had generations of tenure there, so they were often rather surprised to find that some European Zionists had gone behind their back, this began in the late 19th century, to their absentee landlords and bought the land from under them. This started really fermenting ill feeling. Now, then, exactly 98 years ago, the day before yesterday, the British came up with what's called the Balfour Declaration. Now, the Balfour Declaration was virtually a nothing. It says only the following. His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So this is a pretty minimal statement from a power that wasn't, in fact, didn't have political control over Palestine or anything at the time. And the reason we have all heard of it, or a lot of people have heard of it, is that Zionists have used it as a source of legitimacy. Of course, it's nothing of the sort. What Britain declared in 1917 or didn't is really not relevant to the justice of the issue. And I find it interesting that anti-Zionists often talk about the Balfour Declaration as being significant. It really isn't significant at all. But it was just its 98th anniversary, so I brought it up anyway. Then, at the end of World War I, Britain took on a mandate over Palestine, meaning that it assumed control of Palestine under an agreement that basically said that it was temporarily taking over for the benefit of the people who couldn't govern themselves, of course. Now, the main thing you have to realise in trying to assess what the British were doing in encouraging Zionism in Palestine is that different people had different views, all right, and different motivations. Now, some British people, including people in the halls of power, were opposed to Zionism. What I think is key, though, for people to remember is that a very significant faction, a group that was in a position to exert power over what was happening, saw Israel as a way of setting up an enclave of European people who were antagonistic to the local Arab people. Now, Britain had really adopted oil as its fundamental strategic commodity. You know, it had converted from coal to oil after first being pressed to do this by a guy called Admiral Fisher. He started in 1895, and it took them a long time to be convinced to switch from coal, which they had in plentiful supply, to oil. But what they did once they did was they went out to try and control as much of it as they possibly could. One quarter of British Empire troops were directed into the Middle East during World War One, while by far the most intense fighting was happening on the Western Front. So this was pretty much how they gained control of most Middle Eastern oil, and Israel obviously was going to play a big part in keeping control of that in future years. Now, once they had a mandate over Palestine, which of course gave them an obligation to the Palestinian people, and there was the League of Nations Charter and all this sort of thing, so they had legal niceties to observe. But they still wanted to set up this Jewish homeland. And they produced a white paper. And the white paper said, no, you can't do that. That's silly. How could you possibly set up a Jewish homeland in the land of a people who are already there? Well, obviously, this annoyed some people. So they produced another white paper, which said pretty much exactly the opposite. It glossed over all of the moral and legal difficulties with that sort of thing. And then finally they produced a third white paper, which more or less reiterated what the first one had said. It said, you can't do this. It's just not acceptable. Right. Well, in the meantime, of course, then came World War II and the Holocaust. And then after the war, Clearly, there was still a faction thinking exactly the same way. I have to say as well that during the mandate period, the British struggled with insurgency from the Palestinians and with Jewish terrorism. And in some ways, I have to say there was a general tendency to not come down as hard as they might have on Jewish terrorists when Jewish terrorists did things like blow up British citizens, for example. Whereas in the Palestinian Revolt, sometimes referred to as the Great Revolt, there was a lot of violence against Jewish settlers, but largely the Palestinian Revolt was mainly Palestinians attacking the British authorities, and most of the violence, in fact, was inflicted by the British on the Palestinians. So in a sense, the British were predisposing the political forces in a way for what was to come, by repressing one more than the other. So the British could not justify handing over Mandate Palestine to the Zionists. And what they did instead was to basically let things become unstable and then throw it into the hands of the UN. Now, the UN came up with a partition plan. There was a sense of crisis, and the UN came up with a partition plan. This partition plan would give 51% of Mandate Palestine to the Zionists and 49% to the Palestinians. Now, the problem in a way for the Zionists would be that the 51% they were promised would actually have a majority Palestinian population. There was absolutely no way of dividing up the map where you'd get a significant proportion with a Jewish majority, there just wasn't much. There were no Jewish majority areas. So, in fact, the Zionist forces, which would later coalesce into the IDF, began planning ethnic cleansing from the beginning. Now, the partition plan, the British abstained from the partition plan, but strong-armed other countries, including Aotearoa, into voting for it. Right? Now, the UN, therefore, the UN General Assembly, therefore, had imposed upon the Palestinian people a partition of their country, which which was, this was before the, admittedly, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Convention on the Refugee Convention. However, the fact is that they were pretty much breaking their own principles under the United Nations Convention by doing so. Now, predictably, the Palestinians and the neighbouring Arab countries rejected the UN partition plan. There is really no particular reason why they would have accepted it, of course, except for one, which was that the predominant military power in Mandate Palestine, or in the Palestine area, was the soon-to-be IDF, the Jewish militias, which would go on to form the IDF, which were, of course, the formed, which were the very same terrorist groups that were bombing and carrying out terror attacks under the British rule, of course. Now, contrary to myth, it took the neighbouring Arab countries some time to militarily mobilise to oppose what the IDF was doing. And the Zionists, we now know, and Arab historians have claimed this for a long time, but everyone always said they were just biased, but we now know for sure that the Zionists had a plan for ethnic cleansing to be undertaken by massacring civilians, then driving them out. And the Israelis would later claim that the Arabs, foreign Arabs, had told them to leave and stuff like that. It was just not true. So they seized 82% of Mandate Palestine, and the rest was the Gaza Strip, which ended up in Egyptian hands, and the West Bank, which ended up in Jordanian hands. Jordan hadn't exactly played an honourable role in the war against the new Israeli forces, I have to say. But the Egyptians sacrificed many, many, many people. They lost a lot of soldiers fighting against Israel then. Anyway, these would later become, of course, the Palestinian occupied territories. But the point is that the United Nations had created the situation, and they passed a resolution soon afterwards committing themselves to finding a just and lasting peace. Now, number one, can a just and lasting peace come out of a two-state solution which would provide 18% of Mandate Palestine to the Palestinians? I would say that's not true. Number two, can a just and lasting solution come out of any agreement that does not allow all those refugees who were ethnically cleansed from Palestine to return to Israel and have full political rights. No, it cannot. Those people who are often living as refugees in neighboring countries have now sometimes been made refugees again, such as the ones in Syria. And then many of them live in refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza. And you can imagine, I think we all know now, what's been going on in Gaza. That this tiny piece of land with an incredible population density of people who who have no means of being economically self-sufficient, whose very lives are controlled by people who are exceptionally hostile to them, who attack them militarily with some of the most powerful military weapons on a regular basis and frequently refer to it as mowing the lawn. So, just and lasting peace. Does it sound like the INFAT resolution, the draft resolution put forward by the New Zealand delegation to the UN Security Council, is anything like a just and lasting peace? I really doubt it. It is embedding the lies that have been, well, the lies that have become an edifice of official truth in the halls of power. But the real truth doesn't go away. The real refugees don't disappear. Now, the refugees from Palestine are not under the United Nations High Council on Refugees, which was created with the UN Refugee Convention, which came a little over a year after this. However, that convention gives them inalienable rights to return. That means that no one can negotiate it away. The Palestinian Authority can't negotiate away those rights. No one can. So again, just and lasting peace cannot happen without that happening. And those of us who follow these things, we know there is no two-state solution. It's just beyond a joke now. I mean, it's almost like admitting defeat in some ways that Palestinians cannot have self-determination in their own state, but they will be a lot better off if they can achieve political rights in a unified state than they are now under the pretense that there is some sort of two-state solution, because such a thing doesn't exist. So what is our role as Aotearoa in this? We're perpetuating the lie. We're dancing around the truth. And I said it was the whiskey tango foxtrot, my little joke there, but it's also maybe just a little bit of the lickspittle limbo, seeing how low we can go. Anyway, I think I've said enough. Thank you for listening. And, well, next time my country does something that makes me deeply ashamed, I'll probably record another one of these, and maybe you can listen to that too. My name is Kieran Kelly, and you have been listening to me angrily ranting about stuff. Thank you, and goodbye.